You're listening to the sound of a flock of angry crows, but don't worry, this is not, repeat not, an audio version of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Instead, this is the spine-chilling sound that constantly recurs throughout Philip Ridley's typically disturbing and provocative 1992 play, The Fastest Clock in the Universe. Strange music, indeed. I'm Alex Sears, and this is a special Theatre Voice programme about this seminal play. Later on, I'll be talking to Ridley and to two directors of revivals of his work. But to start off, here is a synopsis of the play, whose original production opened on the 14th of May 1992 and was directed by Matthew Lloyd. Intriguingly enough, it was a young Jude Law who played the Foxtrot Darling character. Anyway, let's start with a synopsis. We are in a dilapidated room above an abandoned factory in the East End of London, a room full of stuffed birds. Here live the 30-year-old Cougar Glass and his older friend, Captain Tock. Unable to face the reality of ageing, Cougar holds regular birthday parties, during which he pretends to be just 19. During the play, Cougar and the captain prepare for one of these parties. The younger man has invited Foxtrot, a 15-year-old boy, with the aim of seducing him. When he arrives, however, he brings his pregnant girlfriend, Sherbet Gravel. During the course of a party full of larks, Sherbet ends up by challenging Cougar, unmasking his pretense to be 19, and precipitating a violent fight which results in her miscarrying. It's a typically terrifying and tragic end to a piece of East End Gothic. When I spoke to Ridley earlier this year, I asked him about the origins of the play. Significantly enough, it is rooted in his work as an art student at St. Martin's College of Art in the 1980s. Unlike most contemporary playwrights, Ridley did not do a university drama course. He started his career as a visual artist and novelist. So I asked him where the play came from.
My first stage play, Pitchfork Disney, had opened at the Bush Theatre early in 1991. We were in rehearsals, I remember, kind of building up for the Christmas 1990. All that we were rehearsing Pitchfork Disney at Christmas. There's a surreal image for you. So we were doing all of that, and then Pitchfork Disney opened in early 1991, and I remember that some of the ideas for what would become The Fastest Clock in the Universe were already beginning to take shape. There were certain, I mean, you know, it's not a linear kind of activity for me writing, so it's not like a crossword puzzle that one thing leads on to the next thing, but there were certain things swirling around me in kind of orbit. The last play that I had directed when I'd been a student at St. Martin's with the theatre group, the informal kind of theatre group, if you like, that I had there, was The Picture of Dorian Gray. So that was still kind of flying around in my head, so I've got that. Also, there was at that time, I was reading a lot of Orton, so Orton sort of like was flying around. And even though perhaps I didn't consciously realise that at the time of writing it, in a way that you don't, looking back and reading the play now, I can see Dorian Gray and Orton running through it, like, you know, Brighton through a stick of rock. It's kind of there all the way through. So I had those kind of things. I think the other thing that was kind of there was this kind of new, I mean, I use new in inverted commas, it wasn't new in a sense, no one had ever seen it before, but more of a focus on this kind of male vanity that was really coming to the foreground. And I was seeing it in some of my mates, you know, some of my mates who going to the gym more and more. I mean, it's difficult to think back now, but in those days, going to the gym was still something that wasn't everyday activity. You know, people didn't do that as part of their daily life. I think the gym that was my local gym in the East End of London was above the corner garage, and it was kind of just a bare sawdust floor with a couple of dumbbell weights in the corner and these kind of hairy sumo wrestlers standing in the corner trying to get rid of a few hundredweight of blubber. But there was this new kind of male vanity where men were beginning to preen themselves and to promote themselves as sexual objects, really. I suppose that's the key thing of it, as sexual objects. I mean, men had preened themselves before. Men were kind of almost like saying, we can have it all now. We can have the girls fancying us, and we can have men fancying us. We can just have whatever we like. There was this kind of strange kind of polysexuality that was kind of running through everything. It was kind of all over the place. And that was intriguing me. Because, I mean, I grew up, you know, my kind of adolescence, childhood and all of that. The men who were my mentors and peers, my father's generation, if you like. I mean, my dad wouldn't wear a wristwatch because he thought it was jewellery. You know, so that was still, there was still a lot of that kind of flying around. And of course, this was before you kind of got Marky Mark wearing Calvin Klein's and at bus stops and all of that. And I remember that as a kind of character thing was something that fascinated me, because coming out of the Dorian Gray experience of this kind of cult of physical perfection was something that I thought if I could work out how to use it, was something that was really theatrical, if I could find what context to put that in.
And did you develop the play independent of the Hampstead Theatre, or was it a commission by Jenny Topper?
Well, what happened, Matthew Lloyd, as you know, directed Pitchfork Disney at the Bush, and Matthew was an associate at the Hampstead at that time, and I was working on The Fastest Clock. The thing that was the most important thing for me, I think, as in terms of, if you like, kind of journey as a writer kind of stuff, was what I learned from doing the Pitchfork Disney. Because up until that time, I hadn't seen any of my work staged at all. In fact, the only work in terms of, in very loose inverted commas, theatre that had been happening were the long monologues that I'd been doing, more as performance art stuff, as an art student. So the Pitchfork Disney was a real kind of turning point. It was absolutely fantastic. I could start to learn, really, what the craft, if you like, of writing for the stage was. I mean, I hadn't kind of had that before, really. So, I mean, there are these stories that are kind of going around of how I went to every single... how I was there every single night for the Pitchfork Disney. It's not quite true. I wasn't there for every single night. But I wasn't there, as some might think, sort of like glorying in the event. I was there trying to learn. I was there taking notes, and I was there watching the audience reaction. And
seeing what worked.
Yeah, what worked and what didn't work, where I could lose some dialogue, where it might need a bit more explanation. Just endlessly working at it and watching the audience reaction. And so I was learning the whole time, and I think a lot of, you know, that experience, I really couldn't wait to get on and write the next one, to put into operation what I'd learned from experiencing the Pitchfork Disney. So I had a kind of, the time we came out of doing Pitchfork, I had the ideas I had kind of certain flavours of the Fastest Clock might be, without knowing how these ingredients were going to come together. And I was in talks with, I'd met up with Jenny Topper, who was the artistic director of Hampstead at the time, who I liked very much, who I thought was fantastic. And I continued to work on this. So it wasn't really a commission. I mean, I very rarely do take commissions, because I can't really sit down ahead of something and tell anyone what the play is going to be. It's kind of, if I do, it's going to change. I don't know. I don't know what I'm writing, really, until the end moment.
I know it's a long time ago, 21 years, but do you remember what you did in rehearsals at all?
There was some rewriting that went on. I think that there was a kind of longer speech I remember that Foxtrot had that I cut. But yeah, I mean, there were little tinkerings. There always are the little kind of tinkerings, the odd words here and there. I'd done a lot of work, I must say, I'd done a lot of work on the script with Matthew before we went into rehearsal. So we'd been working on the script because I'd finished the first draft, and then there was a bit of a gap before it was scheduled in the season the following year for Hampstead. So we'd had time to kind of like sit down together and And Matthew worked with me on the script and was, you know, invaluable really in showing me how quickly I could get to a certain point. And that became one of the turning points of the fastest clock, of just the speed at which I could let it allow it to happen. Part of the thrill of watching, I think, the fastest clock is just how it rattles along at this kind of roller coaster tempo.
Yeah, it's got a real momentum.
It just doesn't stop.
What do you remember about that first production?
One, it was just such fun.
Yeah.
I mean, we just spent every day laughing and just having a really good time. It was a fantastic cast. I mean, fantastic cast. And we were doing it in the spring, you know, so it was a kind of lovely time of year. And it's one of those moments where you could feel that it was going to be us against the world when the play opened. Because, you know, we kept on saying, you know, people are just not going to get this, are they? They're not going to get what this is about. I thought, oh, well, perhaps people might be shocked by it. But it never occurred to me.
What aspect do you think we could...
Well, it's difficult to think of now, isn't it? Because it doesn't seem shocking at all. And that's the way that I was thinking about it then.
Were people troubled by the fact that Foxtrot was below the age of consent? He's 15 years old in the play. Or by the fact that he has this uncertain sexuality and that he's being seduced by Cougar, but he's also got a girlfriend?
Well, all of the above, really. I think they were just disturbed by everything. Well, first of all, you know, someone sitting there in their underpants at the beginning, so you're presenting a male object as a not sexual object of desire. And, you know, at that time, people were used to seeing women presented in that. But the fact that I was doing it with a sexy young man who was not only sitting there in next to nothing, but was aware of how good looking he was and was
also a symbol of cool.
Then it turns out that he's living with an older man, and so, oh my god, this symbol of cool is probably homosexual as well. And then, oh my god, he's saying he's kind of this age and he's not that age, and he's going to seduce someone, and oh my god, he's seducing someone that's too young for him. All of that was kind of stuff that people found it difficult to get their head around. In fact, a lot of the gay audience found it very difficult to get their head around at the time. There was a lot of, it seems bizarre to think of now, but there was a whole section of the gay community at the time that thought the play was homophobic, and I was working against the gay community and all of that, and not presenting gay men in a kind of beneficial light. It seems a bizarre thing to even talk about now, but that was part of the kind of like dialectic at the time, that was what people were saying. And you know, and it just escalates from there. And part of it, as you rightly touch on, was the sexuality of Foxtrot. So people were confused by it in a way that I think a lot of that is no longer confusing, which is good, because I think people can see the play a lot more now than they could then, you know. Oh, the descriptions of cruelty towards animals was what was the single most... That was the single biggest comment. I think what it was that there was a description of cruelty towards an animal in the Pitchfork Disney, the first stage play, towards a snake. So sort of people's ears were pricked up, waiting for what's the theme in the work. And oh my god, obviously the big theme in his work is he likes hurting animals. So it was like the biggest outrage for them was not the fact of all this stuff that was going on stage, but the fact that you have a description of the killing and the skinning of animals. Bizarre.
And at the same time, there's this imagery of the birds.
Yeah.
Not only as a stage picture, but also the dying bird and the bird that hasn't got an expression on its face, that whole idea.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, when I look back now, I can see that the play was a kind of rattle bag, if you like, of lots of the stuff that had been going on for the past few years of my time at art school and all of that. You know, for example, we were saying earlier that it's quite clear to see the influence of Dorian Gray in the play, the kind of the whole Oscar Wilde thing about eternal youth and beauty being the ultimate immorality or something like that, isn't it? It's a quote like that. it's the only play in which I've done this, I think, in which, you know, I've kind of really, almost like the junk shop that Captain Tock says he owns, that he's full of all these different things. The play itself is like this junk shop of ideas in which all the kind of scrapbook ideas I've been playing around with have been thrown into the thing. And The Birds is the echo of that. A lot of people think that I'd use The Birds consciously as a quote from Hitchcock, because, I mean, there is a conscious Hitchcock quote, which is the knife, you know, I'm always very insistent, it's a kind of psycho knife that cuts the kind of birthday cake. But actually, the birds in it were not from Hitchcock. The birds were my echo of being obsessed with Max Ernst. And you know those old Victorian collages that he did with kind of women with birds' heads? And he was using birds there as a symbol of sexual suppression, of showing no sexual emotion at all. So the birds in the idea of the stuffed birds and the ornaments of birds in The Fastest Clock has far more to do with Max Ernst and visual art than it has with Hitchcock's The Birds. But yes, I mean, the birds were there almost from the start. I could see that room in which they live very, very, very clearly.
Also, there's that wonderful little anecdote story about the first orgasm the rooftop. Was that something that also comes from those kind of early days when you were at art school?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that in it. I mean, there's more... in some ways, there's more of it in The Pitchfork Disney, but what's more in The Fastest Clock is just the amount of it that's there, in that I can... You know, it's almost like I could do an annotated version of the script, and every line would have a little asterisk by it, sort of connecting it to something else in the work of where this idea came from. So I really like that idea about the play. I mean, it's the only play in which I've kind of consciously done that. But all these references that's been, you know, all these allusions to other things that it's making the whole time is part of that kind of shimmering kaleidoscope, you know, idea on top of idea world that it is.
And one of the influences, of course, is Jacobean theatre, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely,
And also you have these three wonderful quotes as epigraphs, and especially the one from Paul Valéry at the beginning of the play, and it's all about blood as well. So that's a really...
Blood and time.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a really, you know, important theme as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the Jacobean influence is huge, I think. And as is Brian De Palma's Carrie, you know, I mean, it's kind of... Because what it shares with Carrie, and this was saying... I remember we talked about this a lot in the first production, actually, was... what it shares with Stephen King's Carrie is that you sort of know where it's heading. You know that you're in a bullfight and it's going to end with blood at the end, really. So how it's going to end is not really what this play is about. It's the journey it's going to take to get there that is what it's about. You know, the moment that Cougar claps eyes on Sherbet at the end of Act One, you know you're not in for a comfortable ride for Act Two. So it's kind of that aspect of it, you know, intrigued me at the time, and I'm still kind of fascinated by that, that you sort of know where it's going, and are we going to be able to kind of put up with this ride until we get there, you know? And of course the ending when it comes is, you know, or it was at the time, you know, quite explosive. We kind of, you know, the violence that's involved at the end was, you know, had a fair number of walkouts when it was first done at Hampstead. Mm. You could hear the seats flapping up, you know, all over the theatre.
Storytelling, of course, in your work is very important. And there's a couple of things. Obviously, the story of The Fastest Clock, which gets its punchline right at the end of the play, which is lovely.
The last word of the play.
And a kind of slightly fairy tale story. But at the same time, it's storytelling that Sherbet Gravel uses to sort of explode the situation, where, in a fantastic twist, she uses the fact that it's untrue
the whole idea of Savannah Glass, in order to actually provoke.
Well, she subverts it, really, doesn't she, in a really clever way, because what she starts to do is she starts to use their own story against them. You know, she's sort of saying, if you interrupt me on this, or try and prove me wrong on this, you disprove your own story. So you've got to allow me to carry on. And of course, what she's, to a certain extent, inadvertently sailing towards, because she's kind of, she's heading towards revealing the real age of Cougar. What she hasn't quite perhaps worked out, or even Foxtrot hasn't quite worked out, is just how much of a psychopath Cougar is. So she's heading towards a bigger disaster than she ever knows, or is conscious of. She knows she's heading towards a disaster of some kind, or at least a climax of some kind. But she uses Cougar's own story to destroy him. And so she kind of, in a strange kind of way, she emasculates him in terms of the narrative before she goes in for the final kill. So yes, it's kind of, it's control of the narrative in those final pages.
You've talked already about the character of Cougar and his relationship with the captain. Can you say something about Foxtrot? How do you see him?
Foxtrot, in many ways, is the biggest enigma, if you like, in the play, because there are three ways to approach it, if you like. Two of the ways are on either extreme. You can, on one extreme, you can play Foxtrot as being, as Captain Tock describes, the lamb to the slaughter, the complete innocent. The other extreme is that you can play him as somebody that knows exactly all the way through what's going on. But the most interesting thing is the one down the middle, in which Foxtrot is a kind of a new breed of young person that the Cougar and the Captain haven't been able to keep up with. You know, I mean, they are a different generation. Even Cougar, who is trying to make out he's 19 all the way through it, but he's not, he's 30. He's a different generation to this younger generation. So Cougar is assuming that he's got all the aces and he knows all the answers and that he can manipulate, and if you like to use a kind of a contemporary word, to groom the situation. You know, Cougar is kind of convinced that he's kind of in control of it, but you have a much more savvy young person coming in with Foxtrot. That means Foxtrot is kind of, you know, one of those kids that's out there and he's lived and he's been around, and either, or what's going on to a certain extent, is that he's met Cougar and enjoys the attention. I mean, he's recently lost a brother. He quite enjoys the attention that's going on, so he's more than willing to kind of like play the game, if you like, to get out of it what he might be able to get out of it. And in a strange kind of way, this young character has sort of like out-cougared Cougar. You know, the time has caught up with Cougar. Lying about your age is the least of it. There's a generation that's coming along that are more savvy and more aware than you. Your old games won't work anymore. That's what's really the downfall of Cougar. So I think Foxtrot is a very delicate animal to play as a character on stage. But when it's done right, it's absolutely breathtaking. Really is breathtaking.
And what about Sherbert?
Well, as somebody said, she's got all the best lines, hasn't she? It's kind of... I mean, we wait a long time for Sherbert. We wait the whole of Act One to see Sherbert. And she comes on as, you know, Sherbert for me is somebody that I understand inside out. I kind of knew and still know people like that. She's been through hell. She's been involved with gangs and she's seen her life come to the brink, really. She stared into the abyss, and, you know, the old cliche, the abyss has stared up and into her. You know, it's kind of...
And she's only 17.
And she's still young. You know, she's still a girl, and she wants out. She realises that if she doesn't correct her ways, if you like, if she doesn't find a way out of this lifestyle, she's going to die. She's already seen the person, Foxtrot's brother, that she was in love with, die. And so she wants a way out. And so what she's done, like all kind of you know, like people that discover God or people that give up smoking, you know, they become evangelical Christians or evangelical non-smokers. She suddenly discovered a normal life. I've discovered normality. I've discovered the middle of the road, and boy, do I love it here. And so she's gone at this with a kind of, with a passion that is absolutely petrifying. You know, she's kind of like Little Miss Normal on acid. You know what I mean? It's like she wants this normal life. She wants a house. She wants a marriage. And that's kind of, that's the kind of person that I have seen and I know.
The other thing is, of course, she's gutsy, she's a survivor, and she's also very clever.
Incredibly clever. And her, you know, she's street cred, but in capital letters. Mm. She's got an instinctive understanding for people, which is what's led her to understand this situation between Cougar and Foxtrot. One, and when she says, "I kind of knew what you were the minute I saw you," I take her at a word for that.
Let's talk a little about the writing style, because obviously a lot of it is dialogue, but there's also what I think you once referred to as image arias.
In terms of the imagery, it's kind of sometimes an image appears that seems to me to kind of carry a kind of nuclear weight in the play, almost to kind of like sum it up. You know, it's like you feel, I'm very bad at describing this, but it's almost like you feel, oh yeah, the past 10 pages have been building up to this one moment of image making. And of course, that's the way that that's why I use this phrase, image arias. That's the way that arias work in operas, that you lay the themes for what will eventually be the main theme, and then suddenly you get it all cut together. And you feel like you know it because you've been hearing little motifs of those themes for the past 35 minutes. And I think it works like that in the same way, that you suddenly get an image referred to that just unlocks a whole emotional undercurrent of the play that you had been aware of but hadn't been able to kind of articulate or put your finger on. And I think there's certain moments like that. I mean, the key one being the Cheetah Glass one, the big, you know, the big tin box or whatever it is, the big box full of the half-dead animals.
With their eyes
glinting. Looking up, glinting, just these eyes amongst kind of like a pool of blood. Mm. And that's the kind of, apart from, in terms of visual art, an obvious kind of Francis Bacon kind of feel to that, you know, which is another big influence, I guess. But that kind of image seems to me to be an example of what I'm talking about. That, you know, it's a kind of almost like a poster image, isn't it? It's like you're going to do a poster of something.
And my sensation when I hear about that is the idea of cruelty, but also a certain sort of perverse beauty in cruelty.
Well, a perverse aesthetic, you know, it's a kind of the aesthetic of violence, really. Again, I just mentioned Francis Bacon. Again, it comes with the aesthetic of violence is there in that, isn't it? That you can't resist it somehow. That it's barbaric and it's beautiful both at the same time, and that is what causes a kind of dramatic kind of tension.
At the same time, it aligns you, in my mind, with those young British artists of the 1990s.
Oh yeah,
because very much they were exploring similar things.
Yeah. I think, it's give or take a few years. I think all of us were studying art at around about the same time during the 1980s. So those kind of ideas were very much in the atmosphere, if you like. And it, you know, this kind of debates about death and sex and violence and all of that was in the atmosphere. So a lot of my work at art school was kind of exploring those same themes, yeah.
And at the time, in the early 1990s, what kind of reaction do you remember getting from the critics? Because you've spoken a bit about audiences, but what about critics? Do you remember anything?
Well, I think it was seen as something that was outrageous. And it was the outrage of it that they reacted to, that they were outraged by it, that they were irritated by it. And that was kind of, that was interesting. What began to happen with The Fastest Clock, though, was that like with the Pitchfork Disney, there was a kind of younger audience right from the outset that was coming in and was really getting it, really understanding it, and really seeing it as funny. I mean, when the play was first written, when it was, I mean, what I mean by that, when it was written but wasn't either in rehearsal or there'd been no production, when we were getting it together, people used to look at me in disbelief when I said it was a comedy. They could not see how this could be funny. They said, well, where are the jokes? Point out the jokes. And I kept myself, I said, there's no gags as such, but the comedy is in getting these characters together, you know. Apart from the fact that any seduction is hilarious to an outsider, you know, regardless of what that seduction is. Any outsider looking in at somebody trying to get off with somebody else, it's full of giggle factor. But, you know, they couldn't see that it was potentially a funny play. And for the first few performances, perhaps it wasn't. Until the younger audience started to come in and got that actually, yes, it was brutally funny. It's a play about the need for love, and the tragedy of it, Cougar knows that, but cannot access it. That's that meaning of the end. He knows the answer to the question that the captain is asked. He knows that the answer, the way out of this, is to love and not to do what he's doing, not to see people as objects, but to love them and to love them from his heart. And his tragedy is that he cannot find it in his cold heart to access that emotion.
Although it is true that Ridley's work has been embraced enthusiastically by students and other fans, many theatres, one thinks of the Royal Court for example, have traditionally been just a little bit shy of it. In fact, The Fastest Clock in the Universe had to wait until September 2009 before it got a high-profile London revival, once again at the Hampstead Theatre. This time it was directed by Edward Dick. When I spoke to him, I asked him first to outline Ridley's qualities as an artist.
I think, first of all, as a person and as an artist, Phil is... He's an incredibly inspiring person, and he's a true believer. I think it's very interesting that he comes from a discipline, from visual art discipline. You can see a line through visual art and performance art into theatre, and he's uncompromising. I like that about him enormously. Because sometimes I think I'm being a bit uncompromising, and then he pushes you further and he ups the ante. And I think theatre is very important to him. I respond to that, and I think it's been a privilege to do both his first play, The Pitchfork Disney, and The Fastest Clock, revive both of them, albeit not in the order in which he wrote them. So I think he's an important voice in contemporary writing, both in terms of kind of the content and the form of his pieces and the world he explores and how he does that.
How would you describe the world of The Fastest Clock?
Well, it's a theatrically heightened East End world that is absolutely embedded in the real world. I think it's very important when you do these plays that you believe that these people do exist. But you also kind of have to create a theatrical world that allows extremity of the situation to live and breathe. I'm not desperately interested in sort of social naturalism, and although both of these plays use that, they aren't that predominantly, I don't think, and they're heightened, and I think that's sort of the thing that attracts me to them. I had first become aware of Phil when I was a student. I'd seen a student production of Fastest Clock, which must have been 15 years ago, and then Phil had seen a production that I had done at the Bush at the very beginning of when I was just starting out, and and we got to know each other and became friends, and we talked about doing Fastest Clock for ages before finally doing it. I mean, I can't remember, 8 or 9 years, something like that. So, and then Hampstead wanted to do it as part of their 50th anniversary thing. So it was a long gestation period, and then it was kind of time to do a revival of Fastest Clock, and then after that of Pitchfork Disney, the 21 years off anniversary of that play.
Can you talk a bit about the characters in Fastest Clock? Let's start with Cougar.
Yeah. Well, he's Phil's a very visual writer, so the play opens with a very arresting visual image: a narcissistic 30-year-old trying to pass himself off as 19 in his Calvins and his dyed hair in a quiff, sitting in a sun lamp with a cigarette in one hand and a bottle of beer in the other. And that is a very eloquent image to begin a play with, that tells you a huge amount about this character. And yes, he's someone obsessed with holding on to an image of himself and his youth. He has a terrifying visceral reaction to the mention of his age. He has this kind of fit, turns into a wild animal, and like a lot of narcissists, he exists in a symbiotic relationship with someone who enables his narcissism, the captain. And I think that's something that Phil does very well. He writes these very dynamic relationships. You know, the more Cougar preens, the more the captain scurries around him and dusts his antique birds. And, you know, that relationship is very engaging because it's very real. And it's, of course, tested in the heart of the play.
It's a kind of master-slave.
It is. It's a sub-dom relationship, a servant master relationship, and it's a sort of archetypal relationship, actually. And I remember when we were working on that play, we did a bit of improvisation without text, just around the rhythms of the master servant, and because it's a very theatrically potent thing to play with, tested, of course, by the third and fourth character that come into the world of the Fastest Clock. The events of the play do change them, I think. This birthday party, that ritual that Cougar has, it's obviously not the first time that it's happened, but I don't think it's ever gone quite as far through violence and fear as it does in the evening that the play is set. So they kind of come through the fire and are left with one another, and it's very moving, really. And I think you can play the end of the play in different ways, but Cougar does voice what the Fastest Clock in the universe is, what the thing that, you know, it's been set up as the only thing that will save you from the fear of growing old is the Fastest Clock in the universe. And Cougar says, well, that is love. He doesn't say quite, I love you. You know, it's not sentimental or like that, but it could be redemptive. You know, there's at least the possibility of redemption there.
Let's move on to Sherbert Gravel.
Yes. She teases Cougar with her knowledge of the situation and indeed her knowledge of his age that kind of motors the second act of the play. Yes, Jamie Winston played her in my production brilliantly as a kind of very hyper version of... she's an East End beautician with an extraordinary turn of phrase. I remember there's a line in there about feathers being for fucking... But yeah, she's kind of, she's got her own theatrical front, but yes, at the end of the day, she has a kind of street savvy that the others don't have, and partly because they are kind of hermetically sealed away from the street, so you get this burst of energy from the outside that shakes everything up. Through her work, she's a beautician, and she's seen parades of people in a less extreme way than Cougar doing the same thing that he does, trying to hang on to their youth. And she says, "Nature has rules and regulations, and most of them are either cruel or fucking cruel," which is a kind of brilliant piece of philosophy born of her experience.
Can you say a bit about the bird imagery?
Yeah, it's very... when we get to the climax of the play, I think there's a stage direction about everything being very exaggerated. Mm. The electricity doesn't work and is flashing on and off. They live in a flat above an abandoned fur factory that's now full of birds, and the birds scream. It's all very potent theatrical stuff, and I think that's something that drew me to the play as a director, kind of how to deal with all of that expressionistic weight whilst keeping the thing in real, you know, in certain senses.
Okay. What does the play mean?
Well, I think it's about the relationship of cruelty to beauty, and it's sort of given that how do we deal with that. I think Phil posits love as the answer to that, so it is about love and the need for love in an ugly world, and the things that people do to distance themselves from that truth, I suppose. I was directing a production of The Revenger's Tragedy. I think there are many parallels between his work and the Jacobeans in terms of the concerns of those plays, you know, and the relationship between surface and interior. You know, Cougar says, "I can have a gut full of maggots for all I care as long as I've got a suntan," and you think of something like The White Devil or The Revenger's Tragedy, in which the body is rotting beneath a glittering theatrical surface. So those parallels would often spring to mind.
The parallels between Ridley's play and the theatre traditions of the Jacobean, the Gothic, even the worlds of science fiction are one reason why his work survives so well. In October 2013, I spoke to Tom O'Brien, whose revival of The Fastest Clock in the Universe was about to open at the Old Red Lion Fringe venue in London. I asked him when he first became aware of Ridley's work and about its continuing relevance.
When I was about 9 years old, my mum bought me a book called Casper and the Glitter, which I read, and she read at the same time. And I remember, out of all the books I read at that age, which was quite a few, that one just sticks in my mind. I can remember the story, I can remember the characters, I can remember how I felt reading it. So that was the first time I was introduced to him, and I read a few more of his books as a kid as I was growing up. Then I kind of, you know, as I was reaching my late teens, kind of forgot about him, and then went to drama school and found a selection of his plays. Didn't know he actually wrote plays for adults. Took it off the shelf and went, wow, this is the same man that caught my attention when I was 9, and then just read all his plays, you know, within that time.
So what attracts you in particular to The Fastest Clock?
I remember reading it at drama school and having that kind of, when I got to the end of Act One, the heart rate going very fast and having to read Act Two immediately. So obviously just in a pure kind of crass thrill, thrilling way, it really grabbed my attention. but then when I was talking to the producer about doing a revival of Philip Ridley plays, because I was obviously passionate about him as a writer and wanted to work on something of his, The Fastest Clock I found resonated with me, because I was starting to link the themes in that with what's very much surrounds us now. And I think it was this idea of this fake sense of beauty and this aggressive need to stay young. That stayed with me as a theme. And when I went back to looking at his plays, that I felt was, I suppose, the most resonant.
What kind of play do you think it is?
Very naturalistic, and it's absolutely rooted in a sense of real East End characters coexisting in quite a strange but not unbelievable world. But I feel it is symbolism, I would say, in some ways. It's very symbolic. The imagery Philip uses, the situation they're in and also their environment is very symbolic, and actually what they discuss and what they feel and talk about is quite symbolic. So I suppose that's a naturalistic play with a real presence of symbolism there. The idea of the birds for me, and the provocative nature of birds, and the fact that they shed feathers quite easily. But there's a kind of a question when you look at a bird of what it's thinking and what's beneath it, which is very much symbolic of this play. What we wanted to do with the production is really make a virtue of the space that we're in and bring the audience right into the flat. The Old Red Line itself lends itself to the sitting pretty much in the corner. So it is like the audience are in the flat with them. And we're going to create this real naturalistic environment, but that is very claustrophobic. Has the characters kind of written all over it, their footprints, their stains, whether that be birds, whether that be whatever they use. But also we do have an idea of the captain almost renovating and trying to change the environment to please Cougar. That's something we're going down, which isn't in the text, but it's something we're experimenting with. What I'm really want to have is the feeling that there is that presence. We don't know where the birds actually are. I mean, factually, they're in the factory below, but it is very multi-sensory. We're not sure where they are, and we can almost feel their presence. That's what we want to try and create. So I think we will be recording real birds, definitely.
How did this 21st anniversary production come about?
When I approached Philip, he went, "You do realise it's the 21st anniversary?" And that made us go, actually then, with its theme of celebration, of birthdays, of the anniversary, that prompted that.
I know most directors don't like this, but what do you think the play means?
Fear of the unknown, fear of what happens when what we've know or what we've become comfortable with disappears. And I suppose that can be linked to age, that can be linked to the relationships, that can be linked to quite a few things. And also, I think the power actually of sex and how we use sex to get certain things. I mean, everybody uses it or needs it in some way in this play. And I think that's for me quite a strong, I suppose, idea that's underpinned.
It's 21 years old. Does it still have a relevance, do you think?
Absolutely. I think even more than it probably did when it was first written. And that's because I think Philip saw something happening with this metrosexual guy, this guy that was going to, have the peacock effect. And also how aggressively, fierce we are on trying to stay young and trying to keep that, and we'll do anything to do that, even if it means actually damage, hurt people, actually damage ourselves. And I think that is very much, and there is a whole commercial aspect of that surrounds us. And this play in 1992 was looking and starting to explore that. So I definitely think it has a relevance now.
That was director Tom O'Brien ending this special programme about Philip Ridley's The Fastest Clock in the Universe. The other participants were Ridley himself and director Edward Dick. O'Brien's production opens at the Old Red Lion in London on the 5th of November. This will be yet another opportunity, and I hope only one of many more, to appreciate Ridley's particular genius, and to once again behold the gleaming dark.